I am joined by Christian McCracken. Christian McCracken.
It's peanut butter.
I also have with me Kelly Wand, who I'm hoping has a Winter's Bone themed tagline for us this week. Kelly Wand.
I do.
Okay, what is it? Awesome.
If you're related to yourself, you might be a redneck.
I think you stole that.
Yeah, from two people. It's two steals in one line, which makes it mine, JK.
Now, Winter's Bone is a pretty subtle movie, but Kelly Wand, if you were to just discuss the events of the movie, just the straight-up plot, how would you describe to people what happens in this movie?
Oh, you mean a Winter's Boneopsis?
There you go. There you go.
Well, okay, keep in mind, I'm not a professional movie podcaster, so this might be really dumb. But here we go.
All right.
As I understand it, and I, you know, subtleties usually lost on me, as the listeners will know, it's a topical update slash remake of the 1996 classic with my three favorite brat actresses, Shirley MacLaine, Ricki Lake, and Brendan Fraser. This is Winterborn Identity. That was wasn't it? These are hard to debate. It's about a 17-year-old girl who's raising a brood of youngins in a log cabin where they live off squirrels and wood chips, but they're actually really rich because they have the only trampoline in the whole state. And the pigs keep hassling her because her dad was a bad cook and he's missed work for 2 weeks. So she goes to see her sister to borrow a truck, but the boyfriend doesn't let her have it because he's hanging out. So she goes to see her uncle, but she doesn't ask for his truck. So then she goes to see some bitches and dicks, and they give her some coffee and some dental work, but they haven't seen him. So the uncle saves her by telling the oldest dick that everything's cool and he's going to cover for her and not start anything. So then he goes to a liquor store and bashes in a dude's windshield with a hatchet. So that smooths things over with the dicks. And then to smooth things over with her and the pigs, he threatens to shoot one of the pigs while she's in the car by the roadside one night. So then the dicks feel bad for her, and they tell her that they can't give her money or her father back. But they can do the next best thing, which is chainsaw his corpse's hands off while she holds the arms up above this lake. So she sells the hands to a bounty hunter, and her uncle shows up with some baby chicks and teaches the little girl how to play banjo in, 5 seconds. The end.
All right, very good, Kelly Wand.
That was a hard one. The Winter's Bone's hard to do.
I know, I can imagine.
Bitches and Dicks was that awesome bar that they went in and sold, I think.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's actually good. See? Tom? I read Dingus on this. Yeah. He's been up since 5, and he made that joke. Impressive.
There was a bar in this. What was the name of? Didn't they name the bar that they go to in Winter's Bone?
I thought that was the name of the bar.
Since you mentioned that about Salt, I think that was you, Dingus, that caught that. I've been paying attention to the names of bars in movies, and I thought in Winter's Bone, when Jennifer Lawrence and John Hawks go into the bar, thought the name of it was mentioned, but maybe not. Obviously, it didn't make an impression on you guys, so never mind. Forget it.
Well, we're not alcoholics like you.
Sounds like a 3x3, though.
Favorite.
Ready?
Yeah.
Hey, all three of us have Southern roots, am I right? So we're all three of us crackers. Like, I'm West Virginia based, Tom's Arkansas, and Dingus is something. Yep. Am I wrong?
Dingus is something.
Dingus is Virginia. Virginia.
Is Florida or Guatemala? Yeah, Virginia. See, West Virginia is the true Virginia. I don't know what
But this was actually I didn't grow up in this area, but that's the backyard basically of where I grew up. If you drive north out of Little Rock, that's what it looks like, where the movie was set.
I thought of you when she says she has to get down to the border of Arkansas. I say, hey, Tom.
That's that whole, and that's one of the things I loved about this, just the sense of place. I mean, that's, you go north Little Rock and there you are in the Ozarks. This is very, very Ozarks.
You're not kidding about sense of place. Damn.
Yeah. Where was it shot in the Ozarks?
Obviously, you shot it, well, it's set in Missouri, and I'm assuming she shot in Missouri.
Are those real houses, or was that all set? Was that all art direction?
Oh, I'm sure
that's got to be real houses. Those yards, those cars, the siding on those houses. I mean, it's got to be real stuff. And those faces, to say nothing of the faces. But
well, Dingus, you know what? I hate to break it to you, but all of this was shot on a back lot here in Burbank.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, really? Were you there?
Yeah. All the trees were CG, and so was the meth.
And all the dogs were animatronic.
But yeah, it was so obviously it must have been. I'm assuming Missouri. Why would they not shoot in Missouri? For a long time, Arkansas was pushing pretty hard to get movies shot down there. And I think the Nadir, is the Nadir the high part or the low part?
It's the low part. Apex.
The apex of that was getting Sling Blade. Sling Blade was shot in Arkansas, and I don't know that it ever quite. That a movie shot in Arkansas ever quite lived up to Sling Blade. So I don't think this was an Arkansas production. I'm assuming this was Missouri.
Arkansas was always the brown state on the state's jigsaw puzzle. So I just thought it was like less, it was browner than like Tennessee.
Well, you know, it certainly, I can't attest to what color it is on a jigsaw puzzle, but certainly the palette, I mean, that is what, people say the Ozarks are beautiful, and I, you know, who am I to say what people think is beautiful and isn't. But that's what the Ozarks looks like in the winter. It just looks scraggly and gray and undramatic. And they're not even mountains. They're really just hills. But it's such a...
I think it looks beautiful.
Well,
it's just all the poverty in the middle, in the foreground, that's making it seem scraggly. The trees look beautiful.
Well, she talks about her forest, you know, the forest on their land and those 100-year-old trees. And I guess I just am so, not spoiled, but when I think of, like, majestic forests, I think of, like, you know, the redwoods where we were, Dennis,
right.
where Vertigo is shot. Like, that's a forest to me, and these scraggly Ozark stuff is just so impoverished in its own way. You know, the fact that the wildlife are these scrawny squirrels and the occasional deer. A lot of it is the poverty. I mean, that's such a huge part of the setting in this movie. This movie... Mm-hmm. Takes place in a world that's full of guns and drugs and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
It just looked so.
And meth.
The drugs, yeah. And it's not the squaw.
And men. Oh, wait, that's stupid. The dogs.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, so, your point, okay, Tom, is really. I like that because. A lot of the setting of this reminded me of where my folks, my dad's folks come from in central Pennsylvania. It's real coal mining country. And my impression of that area, having been there so many times, is just of such depression. And I remember the first time we took a girlfriend of mine with us on a family visit. And she was just awestruck by the Courier and Ives pictures of this area, and I'm thinking, what are you talking about? This area has been decimated by coal mining, but seen through her eyes, I thought, okay, yeah, there's a real sort of beauty for somebody who's from New Jersey. But what this movie kept reminding me of was that, of just that poverty and that desolation.
What struck me as particularly special about this movie, though, I remember, I think it was Owen Gleiberman, the reviewer for Entertainment Weekly, once wrote a scathing review of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Because he felt that the Coen brothers were making fun of the characters. And I don't know if that's the case or not, but I thought the movie was just so, the characters were just so lovably goofy. I don't know how he got that. But I can sort of understand that maybe you could think, okay, it's the Coen brothers making fun of these people. Because, you know, country...
With love, though.
Right. But, you know, because country people are often made fun of in movies. Like, they're hicks. You know, they're ignorant. And Hollywood kind of laughs at them. And so the thing that I loved about this movie is it didn't flinch from showing these people in the Ozarks. I mean, hicks, hillbillies, rednecks, white trash, whatever you want to call them. It didn't flinch from showing them in a really unflattering light. But ultimately, I loved how it painted a sense of this, of a people with their own moral code.
Mm-hmm.
And the community was just as strong a bit of the character development as Jennifer Lawrence's character. And by the time the movie is over, you know, so much of the decisions go on in the background. The men who killed Jessup, there's this sort of crime family, and it's not about the crime family, but you know they're in the background, and the decisions they make are in a way very noble and very honorable, and they're not dismissive of it doesn't portray these people as just ignorant and amoral and stupid. There's this sense of country honor, which I thought was really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
and very subtle too. That's ultimately, you know, when the movie was over, I liked the movie and even more an hour after I'd seen it, and even more mm-hmm. 2 hours after I'd seen it, and mm-hmm. even more the day after I'd seen it, just because it was so subtle. And a large part of that subtlety was how it portrayed those people.
And it drives the whole plot. Like, it, everything that happens happens for that reason.
Yeah.
Happens because of the codes these people live by. Do we talk about how awesome Jennifer Lawrence is first, or Deborah Granick is first?
Go ahead and get your rawr sound out of the way.
No, I couldn't. I felt really? I was too. Yeah, I mean, and she's beautiful, but I just felt so immersed in her character, like worried for her, that it overwhelmed my lust.
Good.
For once.
You're getting in touch with your sort of paternal side. That's good, Kelly Wand.
Also, she wasn't a very sexualized character. Like, she had bigger fish to fry too. Well, as the chicken fish tank, it was sort of about her sexuality and coming out. And so was an education. But Jennifer Lawrence had real issues to deal with, and I was kind of more like, I don't know, I just sympathized with her too
very
much. Points.
That's a very good point, yeah.
I was smitten with her talent as an actress.
She's in a movie called The Burning Plain, which she plays sort of a similar type character. The guys that did Amores Perros, Arriaga is the scriptwriter, and Iñárritu is the director. They're some filmmakers from Mexico. The screenwriter, Arriaga, went and I think he wrote the script, and he directed The Burning Plain, which is a really erratic movie. It's not that good. It's an interesting script. It's clear that I think he needs Iñárritu to really translate his screenplays. But Jennifer Lawrence is in it, and I remember noticing her from that movie. It's one of those things.
Is she similar? Similar role?
Yeah. It's this sort of southern Gothic, it's actually southwestern Gothic, kind of the mystery about her heritage. And, so I would, if you really liked her, I would recommend Burning Plain if you're willing to. Well, you know what? Burning Plain has some cool stuff in it anyway.
I'll watch her do anything. I found her really engrossing to watch, and her character.
She's phenomenal. I mean, it's just amazing to me to have this performance this year after seeing
Fish Tank.
Jarvis and Fish Tank. I mean, these types of performances from young female actresses, I mean, this is just galvanizing to me to watch.
And directors, women directors, too.
Yeah, that's exactly true. I mean, I felt like, you know, I felt like I was watching, I don't know why I kept getting this feeling. I just kept getting this feeling the way I felt when I was watching Brick, except if the protagonist of Brick had also to be a mother, and as well as all the other things that the protagonist of Brick had to do. I mean, she has so much more burden to carry and is so phenomenal at the shifts she has to make. The shift she makes between when she takes her mother out to the woods to ask her for help, and then has that moment with the bail bondsman guy, where she says, you know, you can go, but you'll be wasting your time and you'll be pissing me off. I mean, she's just got such an amazing profound range and just understands the nobility of this character. And what you were talking about, Tom, about the honor of these characters. I mean, I just get such a nobility of them from that sort of almost that Godfather point of view, but mm-hmm. you know, sort of set yeah. over here. Mm-hmm. And it's just a phenomenal performance. But I felt that way about most of the performances in this. It's just it's just a profoundly phenomenal job of acting across the board. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure where to put Garrett Dillahunt, but almost everybody I was just astounded by.
Garrett Dillahunt seemed to be reprising his role from No Country for Old Men. the ineffectual policeman.
I woke up in this
differences.
Movie.
He was a good foil, though, because she pwned him at the end.
Well, here's something, too. Let's talk a bit about how this movie is so, like Fish Tank, by the way, and I don't know if it's because this is actually based on a novel written by a man, but mm-hmm. it's directed.
Daniel Woodrell.
Exactly, Daniel Woodrell, who has characterized his genre as country noir. I didn't make that up.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Yes.
Country yeah.
noir. Country noir.
Yeah, I want to read some.
He also wrote a historical novel called Ride with the Devil that Ang Lee adapted, which is set in the same part of the U.S., by the way, but during the Civil War.
Is that the Jewel movie?
Yep, Jewel and Tobey Maguire, Ang Lee directed.
And Jeffrey, go ahead.
So I want to talk, though, about how this really feels like it's such a strong statement about how a woman deals with the world of men. And that's very much about like what Fish Tank was about. And I just the movie early on, I love how it's sort of like she has to interact with other women and they have their own ways of going about and finding out things and being an intermediary to another man and how the men in the background or are absent or ineffectual in the sense of the cop. This is such a powerfully, and I hate to use this word because it's a dirty word, but this is such a powerfully feminist movie. In the best sense of the word, about a strong female character dealing with the world of men and how men have failed so often and made this world kind of mm-hmm. this, and women have to clean up after them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things I really, really liked about this movie.
Also, it's like Fish Tank in that it's all from her point of view, too. Like, she's in every scene and you're seeing the whole world from her point of view, just like Katie Jarvis's character in Fish Tank.
Right.
She's in every scene. It's all her. Yep. All the time. Yep.
I love the code that we see develop because, you know, I love what you just said, Tom, because I just love the code that we see develop as far as what the world of women and the world of men and what they're expected to do and who's expected to do what. You know, when I think it's Thump's wife says, ain't you got no men that could do this?
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, yes, that line.
Yeah.
And it's just such a statement of practical. This is not the way things go. And she's no, I don't. And then contrast that with after the beatdown in the barn when somebody's asking, I guess when Teardrop's asking who hit her, and she says no man touched her. The sisters did it. And you just get mm-hmm. the sense of hierarchy and who's doing what and who's, like you said, who's cleaning up whose mess. Oh, man. I mean, this is so far beyond my ken as far as understanding roles of men and women, and I love getting a sense of that world. Just that ain't you got no men that could do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is an area where that kind of thing matters a lot, too. So the sense of place is tied in with that. Same as in Fish Tank, because it's poverty. It's a sign of poverty. It's like the men got to do... They're the ones who can work, I guess. Like, what's she going to do?
Well, men just have physical power in a different way, and then they control the world in a different way, and they just take that on in their swagger. I mean, look at the way Thump walks around that cattle yard. I mean, they mm-hmm. just control the world in a different way, and then women are expected to sort of handle all the background stuff.
And he's got all those fetishes on him, like a warrior chieftain.
What fetishes on? What were those things?
Just like those little epaulets and rhinestones.
Ah, right.
I just love all the all the underneath in the conversations, especially between Thump's wife and Ree, when the first time she approaches, you must have the wrong place, and they have this whole back and forth. And if you've been listening, you got my answer. Don't come back here. He doesn't have time for you. Will he better have time for me because we're family? Those types of things. That there's just this ebb and flow that is fantastic. And you don't get that in the same way in the conversations with the men. The men will grab her jaw, and the woman will throw coffee in her face eventually, but she'll warn her and warn her and warn her first. And also the way Teardrop's wife, or, I'm not sure what, I kind of got lost in some of the relationships here, but the way Teardrop's wife deals with him, and she can be assertive up to a point, and then there's a point where he says, we're done now. And she knows.
And
that.
I told you no with my mouth. That's another thing.
Oh, no, it's I said shut up once already with my mouth.
Yeah.
God, that line.
Yeah. The way he says it, too, like really casually. Yeah. But then he becomes awesome. And also, too, something about the role of men in the society is when he has that line about how he talks about how if he finds out who killed his brother, he'll have to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, he announces that he did find out.
Right.
It's like, yeah, it's just resigned to. That's his duty as a man, is he has to kill his brother's killer now. But that's not the point of the story, so we don't see that. It's about her.
And again, I love how easy that is to miss, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I got the strong impression, I was curious if you guys would agree with this, that clearly at the end, he's basically driving off to his doom. He's basically driving off to commit this cycle of violence. I mean, he can't. He announces early on in the movie, if I find out who it was, I'm basically lost. That's a goodbye scene.
No, that's definitely that. When he says, I know who, after he's had that moment with the banjo, where he says, I was never as good as he was, as Jessup was. That's definitely I'm going to my death. And she tries to stop that from happening. She tries to say, this is our family. She tries to build this sense of defense around that. And he just basically shakes his head and walks off to battle.
And yeah. I think, too, it
doesn't have a choice.
Well, it's I think, another instance of how men are ineffectual. That's not going to accomplish anything. And it's even conflicted with his own moral code. He disapproves of the fact that his brother was a snitch for the police. But and he understands why he was killed, but he's caught in this this sort of catch 22 in his own moral code.
Yeah.
But he feels the need,
my Godfather,
something about it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's that classic sort of gangster movie, character dilemma, but in a different setting. And it's not the point of the movie, though. I mean, because the point of the movie is how I think men are absent and ineffectual, and he's just another one of them, even though he's this really.
It's Godfather told from Kay's point of view.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
That's an awesome sort of point that this story couldn't have been a man's story, because she's saying, I'm going to get past who killed him. I'm going to get past who killed my father. I'm going to work past this. I just have to provide for my family, which should be the role of the man, to provide for his family. But she's saying, this is what I have to do. I'm going to do it, and revenge isn't going to be a part of it. And you can trust that, but you cannot trust that from a man.
Yeah. This is kind of an unsecretary, but in my experience, this is why I prefer working with women. It's like they're always more efficient. The guys are always dicking around.
They won't
step on a check by a woman.
They won't come to kill you, Kelly Wand, if you kill their brothers.
They will, but they'll screw it up because they're too strung out on meth. The women aren't. None of the women in the movie do meth. They got
I don't think we know that. I'm assuming that a lot of the they will give you a doobie for the walk.
I thought that was going to be our tagline, actually.
This movie reminded me a lot. I don't think either of you guys have seen this, but I would recommend it. It's not anywhere near as atmospheric or as polished as this. It doesn't have the performances of this movie. But there's a movie that was shot in Arkansas called Shotgun Stories with an actor I really, really like named Michael Shannon. And it's sort of the equivalent of this movie, but without the benefit of being from a woman's perspective. It has a lot in common with Winter's Bone. Anyone who really liked Winter's Bone, I would recommend Shotgun Stories as a kind of a lesser companion piece.
Is it Sadie Lovers?
It's set in, I think it's actually in Little Rock. I think, yeah, Shotgun Stories is actually set in Little Rock, which is on the fringe of the Ozarks, I guess you could say.
What were you going to say, Dingus?
I was just going to say, you talking about guns just makes me think of the guns in this movie. And there's a couple of moments where you hear gunshots in the distance.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah.
And awesome. The characters don't flinch. They don't flinch.
No, they don't. Mm-mm.
And it's so weird.
I love those.
It's like combat. It's like a war. Mm-hmm.
It's
really distant gunfire too.
But I presume it's people hunting. I don't think it's combat. I mean,
right.
it's hunting. And for us, you know, guys living in L.A., when you see someone teaching a little, I don't know, she must have been 4 or 5 year old girl how to shoot a gun. I mean, I just cringe at that. I'm like, ah. And when she says, "Do you want, you know, here, put your finger on the trigger," when she shoots the squirrel, that's just so weird to me. But that's such a part of that world.
I was so
fond of
that.
The boy had it. Had it.
The boy what?
Sorry.
What did you say?
How to get the guts out and dress the meat and all that. She teaches the girl how to shoot and the boy how to prepare the food. So that is feminist, isn't it?
Well, I love her
right,
constant
go ahead,
teaching. She's got this sense, mm-hmm. and her maternal abilities are phenomenal. I mean, she's just – you have that scene where she's a tourist in the high school at the beginning during the during the junior ROTC stuff. She walks through and she's signing up for something, and she's got to raise these kids, but she's a kid. But she's taking it on herself to do things like, I got to make some deer stew. Y'all come over here and watch how I do this. And she does this time and again. I'm going to teach you how to do this. You got to get over your fear of this. These types of things. Like, mm-hmm. like she knows she's going to be killed at any moment. She's just got this sense of training them and teaching them.
Well, Dingus, I don't think real quick, I want to interrupt you because I want you to come back to that. I don't think it's that she knows that she can be killed, but she knows what it's like to be that to be left to fend for yourself. I mean, it's from her own experience, mm-hmm. you know. Her father is gone and her mother is gone crazy, so she wants to kind of prepare them. It's not so much she's worried about being killed, it's that she knows what it's like to be abandoned like that and left to your own devices.
That's a good
which
point.
Which includes being killed.
Right. But killed or for whatever reason. I mean, that's happened to her. And if she knows that from experience that if that happens to them, she wants to if what happens to them happens to her, she wants to prepare them for it. It's out of her own personal experience, I think. But yeah, go on. You're talking about her powerful maternal instinct, like when she's teaching them, like when she's drilling her sister about how to spell and math and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, when they walk into school and she's teaching them in that sort of haphazard, how do you spell house? And it just has such a sense of a kid teaching a kid. But I get more of a sense of this is a singular moment for her. I mean, she's doing all this walking and walking and walking and putting herself in situations where she could be killed or worse. And somebody says something like that to her. You'll wish you would be killed in this situation.
Oh, et by hogs or wishing you was. Yeah.
Very good. Very good. And she just has to push through it. And I get the sense that the things she's doing when she's teaching them how to make the stew, or she's telling them you don't ask for things that should have been offered, or when she's teaching them how to gut the squirrels, or how to shoot, and there's this this great moment, and I think it's just a real organic filmmaking.
Yeah, I know what you're gonna say. I bet.
Well, when she's teaching them when they're hunting, when they're actually sitting there waiting for squirrels, and she's talking about being quiet, and then there's a sneeze. Just says, bless you.
Yeah.
This is a great little moment. And then the sister goes, it's over there.
Yeah. Beautiful. The sneezer found a squirrel. That sneeze has to have been real. That's that was a perfect sneeze.
Well, and sort of,
perfectly timed.
And there's another very organic moment, too, where when she's talking to them about the gun, and she's like, look at me, blah, blah, blah. No, look at me. You know, that's not written that way. That's just that actress is just so present in that scene with these little kids. And that's just marvelous, marvelous stuff.
She never breaks character. Is she like that in real life? Is she like full-on method actress?
I don't know.
Now my lustmometer's going back up.
Easy there.
Now that I know she's okay. Did it bother anyone that it maybe was did it seem as if it was too easy at the end when the sisters come back and go, all right, we're going to show you where he is? Or was everyone just filled with dread because we weren't sure what was going to happen next? Or whether
I bought the way she said, we have to end this. We have to. This is what we have to do because there's too much talk about it.
Yes, exactly. She had forced their hand, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But she hadn't blabbed.
She hadn't blabbed, and I think that's part of why they trusted her to reveal the location of the body. And even, you know, the thing with the sack, like when they pull the sack off her head, and when I think the actress's name, she was great, who plays her, the character's name was Marab, which is so, like, old. Oh. I have no idea what that means.
I have no idea. I was looking so hard for her, and Marab is perfect.
Yeah, it is. And I think the actress's name is Dale Dickey, if I'm not mistaken. But, God, she was wonderful. The scenes with her and Jennifer Lawrence are fantastic. But when she pulls the sack off her head, and she's like, you know, okay, you may know where you are, but you don't know, you know?
You forget it, yeah.
So I think they trust her at that point. I mean, this whole code of honor, they know she's not going to talk. They know she's not in it to get anybody in trouble. You know, they know the straits that she's in. And they're like, you know what, okay, we're going to give you his hands. And it's not easy, too. Like, it's a pretty grisly thing. They could have gone out there and cut the hands off.
Right.
That's a pretty grisly thing to put her through. And I've got to think that's part of their decision. You know, okay, we're going to do this, but we're not necessarily going to make it easy for you. You've got to be committed. Here you go. Mm-hmm. We're going to go out and make sure that you don't. You know, that's her dead father's hands that she's cutting.
Yeah.
And Marup even seems to think that Ree is going to run the chainsaw. She's like, there's the chainsaw. Cut off his arms.
Well, that's the rules. And she has to break the rules there. I mean, she turns to the sister and says she can't do it.
Yeah.
And she takes care of it. When she shouldn't have, because that puts her in danger. And then she puts, in the final touches, then she puts her coat over Ray after this is done.
Right.
I mean, there's a real sense of compassion and that Ray has sort of passed a test.
Yeah. And I love the black humor, and it even got a little bit of a, I saw it at a pretty crowded theater, it even got a little bit of a laugh. When Ree lets go of you know, her father's body, and Marab says, no, you have to take the other hand. They know that trick.
They know that trick. Oh!
That's just such classic, like, gothic black humor. I love that moment. The fact that she believes that there's a trick that people will take a chainsaw to cut off their own hands to fake their death if they jump bail. I love that.
The two hands is necessarily legitimate.
Right. As if nobody would have that level of
commitment. Same DNA. Right. Oh, no one would do it with two hands. And it's a right and left hand. But they have his prints. Can they get his prints from one hand? Never mind. I just felt bad for it.
That's part of that sort of Southern Gothic. You know, it's one thing to be grotesque, but you got to push the grotesque a little farther.
It's very Cormac.
It's very Cormac McCarthy. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Very William Faulkner.
Yeah. Ooh, good one.
I loved some of the language in this movie. There were, and
you
not
mean all the language,
and not just for the dialect, and not just for the regionalism stuff, but there were parts. There's one point. Now, Kelly Wand, you said that the blonde girl was her sister, but I don't think that's the case.
No, I think they're cousins, maybe.
Yeah, and at one point when the blonde girl, I think it's when the blonde girl's helping her. Like, I love, for instance, when she's tending to her wounds, and it's a fairly tight shot of the two of them from sort of the shoulders up, and she's tending to her wounds. She's like, okay, this is going to hurt. Now just squeeze my hand. You know, she's been holding her hand the whole time. You know, that's such a feminine thing to do, is when you tend to someone's wounds in a movie, you know, it's with dudes, it's like, suck it up, or here, bite on this, chew on, you know, leather in your mouth. But with these two women, they're holding hands. That was such a lovely moment. But at one point, Ree says to her friend, and I wrote this down, "You are what I always did think you were, darling. You truly are." Like the in that line is just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not contrived. It's not forced. It sounds so regional, and I can't do it justice. But just the delivery of that line was just amazing work. Go ahead, Dingus.
The one that got me was just this little line: "She don't shine for them."
Yeah.
is after and I got a little confused about some of the guys in this. They got some of the bearded guys got a little interchangeable for me. But the
racist.
He's going to take Sonny so he can raise him up the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. And then this cousin says, what about, I think Ashley is the little girl's name. Mm-hmm. And she says she don't shine for them.
Well, it's Ashley and her mom. What about Ashley and your mom? Like,
she don't shine for them.
What's the teardrop actor's name?
John Hawks.
I want to do my favorite.
John Hawks.
John Hawks.
John Hawks.
When John Hawks has the gun on his lap and he goes to Sheriff, is this our time?
Is this going
to
be our time? Yeah.
Is this going to be our time?
And he does it in the mirror. I mean, John Hawks is such an overlooked actor. That guy is fantastic. I've liked him for a long time. And I was
It's so good to see him play this character after, mm-hmm. I think the last thing I really remember him from is he's Bound and Down. It's so good to see him he's just got such a power about him. There's this great moment when they're all in the barn after the beatdown and they hear the truck and the fear in Thump's crew. It's just the sound of the pickup truck. And they're like, we got to get out of here. They're the guys who will not stay.
That's right. A bunch of the guys like retreat into the back of the barn.
They're like, yeah, I'm not staying here. They know the sound of his engine and they know him. And he's not like this big imposing figure, but he is menacing. But he also gets the flip side of that. He gets how to be the family to her. He's great.
Well, there's so much of like he lives up to that character. When she says to him, you've always scared me. And he says, well, that's because you're smart. I mean, he earns that line. He earns that observation. Yeah, and I love, too, how that scene, you know, is this going to be our time? You know, how it's mm-hmm. two men talking through a mirror. Just the blocking right there. Garrett Dillahunt against the back of the car, you know, tapping the car with his pistol. John Hawks raising it up where you can see the rifle in the mirror. Just the dynamics of that scene were just amazing. And I, in a way, was like, oh, this is going to have some violent, bloody showdown. And it does, but we don't get to be a part of that, I presume, and that's fine with me. I was worried that this was going to end up being just like a simple shootout, or he was going to do like a taxi driver at the end. I love that the movie kind of respects, I want to say respects his privacy, but that's not quite it. It respects her perspective on him enough that it didn't become that kind of movie. And, you know, the fact that John Hawk, that the teardrop knows that the sheriff is going to back down, I don't think he's endangering her. And so that when she drops the hands off and the sheriff has to, you know, Garrett Dillahunt, like, you know, I only walked away.
Yeah.
He drew me, not because he stared me down, because I was worried.
Reputation.
He is so flustered. Mm-hmm. He's such like an ineffectual man compared to John Hawks. I mean, Teardrop, that was just another fantastic instance of, you mentioned him before, I think Kelly Wand is a foil. But I loved that bit. And I'm so glad we didn't have to see, you know, it didn't become a movie about a shootout.
It's a verbal shootout that she wins in their last scene together. She gets the last word in.
Right.
I forget what she says, though.
I never even talk about you, or, yeah.
Yeah, you're not even worth, you're not even worth, like, spreading gossip about. You're such a big pussy.
He never backed me down. That was so impotent, wonderful.
Yeah. And a southern, like, there's a southern man, gentleman's honor at stake. He's telling the bell.
Did you guys see the poster for this?
No, because it was a spoiler.
Are you saying
it's not afterwards? It's like her hair.
I mean, it's the poster is the women rowing out in the boat.
Oh, really? That's a huge spoiler.
I think so.
That's on the poster, really?
Yeah,
the only poster I saw looks like Galadriel.
Yeah,
yeah. She's on the clouds, and it's completely crystal.
She's up in the sky, and her hair is streaming behind her. But if you look underneath it, it's all the women rowing out in the boat.
I don't like that.
I mean, it looks like, what's this about? Is it about, you know, women going to sea or something?
Well, that title, you know, it's going to be something horrible because the title's ominous.
You know, which reminds me, this director was not at all who I thought she was.
Same here.
All afterward.
And I think I'm responsible for that, Dingus, by the way.
Okay, I'll give you that. I thought we were talking about the Frozen River woman.
And yeah, that was my mistake. It's not the woman that did, because I was actually, while I was watching this, I was like, wow, she's come a long way since Frozen River.
Just looking at the acting and the actor she chose, I was stunned.
Yeah,
I kept thinking of the kids in the trailer and that poor Native American or Eskimo woman.
But no, this is, so as you probably know now, Dingus, Deborah Granick, who directed Down to the Bone.
Which makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Right.
But Down to the Bone was so just unrelentingly bleak and difficult to watch. This, in a way, was very... I mean, this was a movie about... You know, Down to the Bone is sort of about a woman falling prey to her addiction. Down to the Bone is a sort of a tragic downward spiral. It's almost actually one of those, what you've coined the phrase, junkies are tedious movies. But I thought this was a very sort of encouraging, hopeful, very humanist movie. This one just felt more like positive and in a way less bleak. I mean, you get the sense, you know, she comes out of this, the far end of this, and it didn't feel contrived, but she comes out of this, she's secured a place for her family. You know, she's got money. There's even this almost deus ex machina at the end where she gets a bit of money to save the land and save the little kids.
I think it earns that. I think you're right, but I think it earns that moment.
So just because it is so subtle and understated, I want to make sure I have it right. So the idea is her father was a meth dealer who gets arrested.
He's a cooker.
Right,
a cooker. They all cook eventually.
You don't even have to say it.
He snitches to the cops in order to, he cuts some kind of a deal. Presumably, now, I don't know if it's because he's spineless or because he wanted to provide for his family. For whatever reason, he becomes a snitch. So Thump goes or gets someone to bail him out, puts up the money in addition to the house because that didn't cover in the property. That didn't cover everything. Bails him out and murders him. Dumps his body in the lake. And the sheriff knows, and the sheriff actually is the one that gave him away to Thump. Is that correct?
Yeah, but what was his plan when he pulls the car over?
Well,
that's what I didn't.
That was
understand.
Just because he just smashed a windshield with an axe.
Right. It's on.
He
now.
Said it's not about you. It's about your brother, though. And he has his gun out, kind of. He's acting cautious even before Teardrop draws on him.
Well,
I don't know. Am I misremembering?
No. You're. I mean, I think it's either because of the axe or. I think part of the implication might be that the sheriff is in Thump's pocket, that there is some sort of a deal going on with the meth dealers, you know, this crime family. Because Thump isn't just a meth dealer. I mean, he seems like it's like a cattle baron almost, it seems.
Mm-hmm. But what's the sheriff going to do to him?
I'm assuming arrest him. And, you know, they beat him. You know, maybe they have to have people missing. Who knows?
Well, I think part of the problem is that she's there.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that would have shaken out quite differently if she hadn't been there. And I think he said.
But they knew she was there when he did the windshield thing.
Yeah, but the sheriff doesn't necessarily know that.
And Kelly Wand, I don't think they did know.
Really?
She's in the truck. If you remember, inside the truck. He comes into the bar and she points out that they're standing in front of a store at another location than where they just were.
And you think they would have used the sheriff to do that? Like the biggest pussy in the town?
Well, but see, that's the thing is I think there's some sort of going on with the sheriff being in the pocket of this crime family. You know, it's like, hey, this guy is on to us. He's asking questions about Jessup, who, as you know, we killed. You need to go scare him. You need to go shake him up. So the sheriff gets in his car and pulls him over.
And does nothing.
Because he gets back down.
Yeah, I know, but I just...
Well, he's right. He does nothing. I mean, he's, you know, he's the Garrett Dillahunt from No Country for Old Men. You know, he's that level of law enforcement, I think.
It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I'm just surprised. It's like I want to make sure that I got it right, too. And I'm just like surprised because I'm surprised I didn't get that they would have used the sheriff over the windshield thing. Like, that seems kind of like not a very Southern gentleman thing to do. Like, you handle it yourself, you know, call in the 10-star lackey. I don't know.
Yeah, you might.
They're afraid of Teardrop.
That's a good point too. It's like, hey, let's get the sheriff to deal with him. Yeah,
he'll handle it. Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
And so they're yelling after him. They're saying like, it's on, it's so on, and we're coming for you, and we're bringing hell with us. And they send the tool.
Yeah. There's your hell. Yeah. To do nothing.
I love it. Go ahead, Dan.
As far as the father is concerned, I think you're right. I think the key is in what Teardrop says, that he loved you all and that was his weakness, or that's where he went weak. And I think that's sort of the key to who this father character was. I mean, he eventually went weak because he loved his family, and then he couldn't save them, even though sort of we spend most of the film thinking he's just a deadbeat.
Which, by the way, Dingus makes the fact that she, you know, makes her having to cut off his hands. Like if he'd just been a deadbeat who had never been around, then that scene doesn't mean as much as if he really did care for them. I mean, there's a point where you see the picture of the family, but I think the assumption throughout the movie, you're right, is that he's a deadbeat who wasn't around. But mm-hmm. that's kind of a reveal, is that that may not have been the case, is that maybe he was just, it's because he loved them, yeah.
And screwed them out of the house. That makes him look a deadbeat, too. I
think he was going to, you know, I don't
even though he was a snitch, you think that would have got him a better deal?
He didn't plan to jump bail. I mean, he just needed to get out. He needed to get out of jail.
But it's his assassins help pay his bail.
Exactly. Right. He didn't have quite enough, so they make up the deal.
So he really got screwed on the house.
and they can't very well show up and reclaim the money, because that then implicates, you know, that then there's a connection between who bailed him out and when he went missing. So that's why I sort of think that it earns this fact that she gets a nice sum of money. We don't know how much, but she gets money dumped into her lap at the end of the movie.
See, the bounty hunter's not ineffectual. Deus Ex Machina guy.
You know,
that should have been a chick bounty hunter. You heard me.
There were a Domino. They should have sent Domino in there.
There were a couple of characters. Like, I liked that guy at first. I was like, okay, he's just going to be you know, the jerk cop kind of guy, bail bondsman. But I liked his character. I liked the fact that, you know, at the end, he wasn't just a jerk. He wasn't just a hard ass. And I really like Dingus. I'll be curious.
Oh, I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
Yeah, I really liked that recruitment officer guy. Where the guy basically says, you know what, honey, you need to stay home. And he didn't call her honey. I just called her that. He says, you know what, you need to stay home and provide for your family. It sounds like you've got it tough.
She is a honey, though.
That's
a great scene.
It's such a beautiful contrast to the, you know,
I know what you're going to say.
In The Messenger. And that sort of bolsters what you're saying, Tom, about the hopefulness in this, is that, you know, he takes care of her. And there's this lovely moment where she's asking about the $40,000, and he says it'll be in, you know, from 15 to 80 months. And she's
15 to 82 weeks, yeah.
I'll say that in the poster.
Well,
you know the reasons. Yeah.
It's a clerical error that's not on the poster. And he's just so gentle and just, you know, this is the hard thing, but you got to do it. And I loved that scene. I loved him.
Yeah. The power of Winter's Bone is it made me like an army recruiter character. Like, in sympathize. That guy's cool.
Although
it didn't help. Yeah, go on.
I was going to say, how about this for medical advice? As far as taking painkillers, start with two and build whatever
but
numbers.
Start with two.
But it's whatever numbers, let her rest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like it. I want to get some of those.
The beautiful moment for me after that, because I've got a kid losing teeth, is when the little kids put her tooth in the jar of water, mm-hmm. which is very much a tooth fairy thing. And I just love that. There's so many little touches like that.
Yeah. Another silent scene, too. There's a lot of, like, just silent looks and ceremonies and rituals.
And how about that squirrel dream?
That's a staple of noir, isn't it? Where the hero gets drugged and has some sort of hallucination.
About squirrels?
Well, no, it's like I'm thinking of Gutter Balls in Big Lebowski. It's just the equivalent
thing. Right.
Well, one of the writers or producers, one of these, somebody had something to do with the Cthulhu movie, and that whole squirrel thing sort of made me think of that. I don't know.
Yeah, wait a minute, what?
Why are we talking about? Start all over. Just say that again, but with veracity.
Take two, Dingus.
I apologize. I'll just
Cthulhu
move
movie.
On.
No, did you make that up? What Cthulhu movie are you talking about? That's such a weird, random thing.
What does that have to do with squirrels?
I mean, you're probably right. No, I want to know. I'm dying. That sounds really interesting. What are you talking about? Hello?
Did he leave? You ran him off, Kelly Wand.
After that, oh, he taunted us with the Cthulhu and leaves. Ooh. Dingus, we miss you.
Can you not hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Now I can.
All right, well, maybe
Cthulhu,
a hallucination.
Go. A squirrel hallucination?
I thought somebody in this movie had something to do with the Cthulhu movie. And when I saw that, I just thought of that squirrel dream.
Someone behind the camera?
Yeah. Like a producer or a writer had something to do
Start
with it.
Start with two, Dingus. Oh, yeah, you're right. You know what? Dingus is not high. Co-producer of Cthulhu, the movie, Tom, which neither of us saw.
No, I've seen it.
Which it's annoyed me because I remember it.
No,
isn't it set in Innsmouth? But, like, Cthulhu's the Pacific. Oh, wait. They moved it to Seattle, Oregon coast.
I don't know what you're talking about, Dingus, but Kelly Wan, but Dingus is talking about a black and white. Is it At the Mountains of Madness? No, which one is it, Dingus? What's the name of the Lovecraft story that you're talking about? It was made into a little silent movie. That's what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, yeah.
No,
but
it's not what
it's called. But so I must have just sort of pushed the two.
That's
together.
Just called Call of Cthulhu, but I think you're both high, and it's. Anne Rossellini, the co-writer of the screenplay of Winter's Bone, was a co-producer on Cthulhu, the movie I'm talking about, which is set in Oregon.
One, two, three, not only you and me,
I jumped the gun. Sorry. I thought that was a good segue. Hold on, I'm going to start over. Pretend that didn't happen. All right, continue.
You just screwed over Anne Rossellini. No, it's fine.
Well, she's
screw over writers.
She co-wrote
another
script.
Girl.
Yeah, yeah. She wrote the script for Deborah Granik, right? I didn't know that she had done a Cthulhu movie, but I'm proud of her. And I presume that that's probably where the inspiration for a little 16mm fever dream about squirrels in the forest being chainsawed. I see the connection. Yes.
Thank you.
That was so worth 20 minutes. Thank you, listeners. One, two, three.
All right.
Horrifying.
Okay, so Kelly, say something inane or funny. Go.
Stupid?
Okay, that'll do.
One, two, three. Not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between. Counting one, two, three.
All right, let's do a 3x3. Speaking of stupid.
That's the longest it's ever taken me to say something stupid.
Speaking of stupid, awesome.
What is this? 3x3.
Oh, good Lord.
I thought it would be fun, but I guess it wasn't, because it wasn't fun for me. So I'm sure you guys hated it. But, you know, some of these 3x3s are for the listeners, because they'll come up with cool ones that we didn't think of. We'll go, oh, yeah, great. Thanks for not listening to our podcast. And hello?
All right, what do you got? Go ahead, introduce it. What do you got for us?
Dingus. Is Dingus there?
Dingus is, I think. Yeah, Dingus is there.
I'm here.
All right. Okay. All right, it's so three best uses of lava. The end. And it has to be liquid lava. I think I forgot to mention that last week.
Yeah, you didn't make that stipulation, except. Yeah, but if it's not liquid, it's not lava. So.
Now, can it be molten?
If it bends, it's funny.
Can it be molten steel, Kelly Wand?
Tom, stop. Stop talking.
No Terminator 2.
Whoa,
it's too late. You didn't get a chance to do that. Sorry.
That's not lava. It's not lava. So.
Let's move on.
It didn't come from a volcano. It's not
right,
lava.
So Dingus, you're going to next week's 3x3, so you go first. What's your number 3 top use of lava in film history?
You know, I'm glad you asked me that, Tom, because I've got
this is officially the worst podcast we've done, and I feel bad because it was one of the best movies we've ever seen.
No, we did a good podcast. Well, Kelly Wand, I agree with part of what you're saying. I thought we did Winter's Bone was great. I enjoyed talking to you guys about it. I do think this might be the worst 3x3 topic ever, and I think that's an achievement in and of itself. I don't intend that as an insult.
I have better ones. You have to wait 3 weeks now to hear them.
What's awesome is that you introduced this by saying, in 3 weeks I'll have a great one. Here's this week's.
That's true.
Yeah. I switched them. Sorry. Here we are with this piece of crap. Get ready.
All right, so Dingus, you're...
This one does suck. I agree with you, just so we're clear.
So Dingus, we even said that it sucks. Nobody said it sucks.
I did.
No, oh, no, yes. Well, I would have, if you guys could have overruled me and I asked
no,
you,
we
you
cannot.
Want a better one. We want to do this crap. You want to whine about it next week?
No. Kelly, you have to take responsibility for your own 3x3. We're not going to override you. We're not going to shout you down. We're not going to vote you off the island. 3x3, we take turns being in charge of what it's going to be. You have to own this, Kelly Wand. Okay?
Island is a spoiler.
Lava.
You also have to earn this, Kelly.
You know what? I have to admit, I did it because I knew Tom would hate it. But then it backfired, and I wound up hating it just as much as Tom did. And I'm like, oh, this is a piece of crap. I hate this topic. Stupid, boring crap.
I'm sure Dingus looks at that. Dingus, I know, at least took it seriously. So we know at least one.
I drag you down with me. Ha ha. Gotcha.
All right, Dingus, what's number three? What do you got for us?
Yeah, Dingus will have a good rebate. Dingus is a very serious lava enthusiast, I've learned from hanging out in his pickup truck.
But only the soap. All right, my quote for number three is this. Will this melt in the lava?
Give us another one. Give us 16.
Okay, the other quote would be...
Caveman.
When does Schwarzenegger throw something into lava?
I didn't know
it's got to be Terminator 2.
Oh, yeah, it's clearly Terminator 2.
Which isn't lava, it's molten steel.
Not lava. Fail. Epic fail.
Well, sorry, at the end of T2, a young and douchey John Connor poses this question to the Terminator, and the Terminator says, yes, throw it in. So the question
just patronizing
is,
a little kid, though. The kid doesn't
know matter. The Terminator could easily have corrected him, and he chose not to. So tacitly, he has decided that this is lava. The line is, will this melt in the lava? And the Terminator says, yes, throw it in. And he has gone ahead and said, yes, this is lava. So
I think Dingus has totally trumped us on that, Kelly Wand, because I would have said the same thing. Right? It's not lava, it's molten steel. But
if James Cameron thinks something's lava, then it is lava. Even
it's either lava or unobtainium.
And in Terminator Salvation, one of the Terminator motorcycle guys misspells brake. It's just like engage brake, BREAK. And he's a Terminator. Just saying.
Oh, you mean on his HUD? It says that on his HUD?
Yeah. His HUD goes engage brake, like lunch break. Hi, Terminator Salvation. I can't make it through that whole movie, but I did make it through the 1 second thing. I can't get to the Arnie part successfully.
Kelly Wand, you've got to be inventing that. Is that really true?
Hello?
Hello.
Wow, I guess it's not true.
Wow. That was so untrue it knocked him off the podcast.
All right, well, I'm going to go on to my number three while we wait for Kelly Wand to fix his mic. My number three is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Okay. I'm pretty sure there's lava in that. Isn't there lava in that, Dingus? Back me up.
I'm going to say yes. There's lava in his chest because the guy pulls lava out of his chest.
The heart where he's sacrificing the little kid, right?
Yeah, I think that there's a pit of lava that he's hanging over. Yeah, good one.
And the reason that this is significant is it's the first time that lava has earned a PG-13 rating. So.
Oh, good point. All right. It actually created one.
That's right, for lava, for lava violence.
Yeah.
All right, Kelly
Thanks, Walker. Lava, for giving us the PG-13. That was the last cool... What's wrong with my voice tonight? I sound like a eunuch. I mean, more so. Yeah, what?
That was my number...
That's a good one, damn.
All right, Kelly Wand, what is
I'm
your...
I'm a Temple of Doom apologist.
I think we all
you
are.
You don't want to talk about Temple of Doom at all? All right. That's a great movie, isn't it? It's kind of the best one.
It's fashionable to say,
all right, my number three is Adaptation. Go.
What? Lava in the beginning of Adaptation. Very good.
When you find out L.A., we used to be lava, and basically nothing's changed, and it's still a tar pit / brothel / cesspool of bubbling lava.
Wow.
That's deep, Matt.
It is.
It's no Temple of Doom, though.
As far as lava is concerned, I agree with you there, yeah.
Yeah, it's because of lava, PG-13 exists. That's such a weird thing, isn't it? That was the only... And it was that in Gremlins, which had a microwave.
Gremlins got a PG-13? What are you talking about?
No, but it was the same summer, so it was like that's when everyone went, whoa, dude, these movies are too intense for youngsters.
Right. Gremlins 1?
And then everything ruined forever. Intense for youngsters? Isn't that how Ree would have put it? I hate myself. Okay.
That's how
that's
we
my number three,
you.
Adaptation.
All right,
the tag is intense for youngsters.
All right, just for that, the next 3x3 I announce is going to be even lamer than this. Take that.
Wow.
Friends.
That will be an accomplishment.
Yeah. That's a challenge, isn't it? And I'm prepared to meet it.
All right, Dingus, what's your number two favorite use of lava or molten steel mistaken for lava?
All right, this is actual lava. This is bona fide lava.
All right.
This is totally lava.
Dingus, real quick, hold on, before you go to there. Why don't you explain to the listeners what lava technically is?
Lava is molten rock.
Hmm. So it's melted.
Not steel? It has to come from a volcano.
Wait, let's get down
Isn't
to the science of it.
The so listeners will make
it's basically, Dingus, you're saying it's rock that is melted. Is that right?
Lava is molten rock that's come out of the earth. So when it's in the earth, it's magma. When it comes out, it's lava.
Whoa, is that true? That is true. I think you're right. Wow. All right. Did your son teach
according to Wikipedia.
You that? Thing is, did you know that, or did your son?
Has to be volcanic.
To answer
so Cameron,
your query,
Cameron's an idiot. Just so we're clear on this.
I don't
so
think
Dingus
that's in question.
Be going and
so
it
yes, Tom.
Longs,
wow. Okay. Yes, Tom. My son did teach me that.
Ha. All right. Can we get him on the podcast?
Save your man. Instead of Kelly.
No, instead of me.
I did. I really did like Dingus here. The distinction between lava and magma. That was good. Kelly Wan, did you know that?
No, I didn't even hear him. I was busy looking it up to make sure I wasn't an idiot. And I'm not.
What is your number two? So I'm assuming magma is a lot. Like, for instance, if someone wanted to use a movie that takes place under the crust of the Earth, magma is allowed for this topic.
Spoiler.
I don't know if Kelly Wan will put the kibosh on that or not, but we'll see. So Dingus, what is your number two use of lava, magma, or mistakenly identified molten steel?
All right, here we go. Here comes the quote for you, fellas. I'm watching the last day of the United States of America, and by tomorrow, all of mankind. And we will be visible from the Milky Way as a tiny little puff of smoke. I'm watching the Earth crumble before my eyes.
2012.
You're absolutely right.
Is that true?
Yes.
No, not 2012. It is 2012. Right. What?
Yeah, it's 2012.
Wow, who says that? That's terrible.
After he says yes, you can assume the answer's it.
That's Woody Harrelson watching the caldera explode.
Wow. Oh, that's right, the lava. Yeah, oh, I wish I'd... Now, is that lava when it's... I guess the chunks of burning rock, do those qualify yet as lava?
They do now.
Okay.
According to Edward Furlong and James Cameron...
It's such a horrible movie, but the RV fleeing, the flying bits of lava, and the plane having to dodge them, it's just priceless.
I get
so you're putting.
I get sleepy just thinking
2012.
That movie. I'm falling asleep now. Just think.
Yeah, I thought of it. I was totally like, well, it's the only lava movie I've seen. And then I was like, I can't talk about 2012 even for 5 seconds, especially on a podcast about Winter's Bone. It's just such a violation.
I feel pretty guilty, but I'm all right with it.
Shame on you.
If you guys feel guilty about 2012, dig my number two. It's the Star Wars one, that last Star Wars prequel with the light fight. Where he, like,
bullshit.
And I think,
you are not.
Yeah.
No.
It's like, hey, the Jedi are here, or whatever it's called. Like the.
So, despite the topic, you're actually going to have a Star Wars movie.
I am.
You. This Star Wars
last Star Wars prequel. Because I seem to recall, like,
there's... Such Kelly Wan. That's how crappy this topic is.
Doesn't Christian Haydenson, like, fall down next to the lava and just, like, burn?
He gets Obi-Wan gets the high ground, so that's how...
That's right. The lava is tactically significant.
Even though Mace Windu has the high ground on Palpatine and earlier.
Is there lava?
But they actually fight while surfing on lava, don't they?
There's lava surfing. That's right. Yes. Oh. It's like a video game.
Yeah, the special effects are awesome. And I love that you called the movie, Hey, the Jedi Are Here.
What is it?
Tom never even named the movie.
Is it Revenge of the Jedi? No, what the heck is it
Revenge
even called?
Revenge of the Sith.
Revenge of the Sith, right.
Don't pretend, Tom.
I really, you know what? I swear on my grave that unless I'd looked it up, I'm not sure I would have come up with a title. That's how inconsequential the, like Reese says to the sheriff, I don't even talk about you. That's how I feel about the Star Wars prequels. Although here I am talking about them.
George Lucas doesn't bother to tell us what they're getting revenge for in the movie either. We just assume they're getting revenge on something.
Yeah. And that shows my disdain because I picked 2012 over that.
Yeah, you suck, Tom. That's really bad. I'm very upset right now.
There you go. Well, what's your number two, Kelly Wand?
Joe versus the Volcano, a good movie instead of what you guys are talking about.
I've never seen that. Is that a movie? And is the volcano a metaphor, or there's really a volcano in that movie?
Oh, you didn't see Joe vs. Volcano? It's the directing debut of Patrick Shanley. What's his name?
John Patrick.
The guy who wrote Moonstruck. John Patrick Shanley.
No, you're making
it's totally underrated.
No. I always think
it is connected to
Johnston.
Oh, that's right. That's like a just movie to me too, just because it leads off with Joe, and it sounds like something that Joe Johnston would do.
I haven't seen it either.
Wait, what's that line? What's the Dan Hedaya line?
No,
he has the job. Can he do the job? Never mind.
That sounds like Mammoth.
You guys have to see that movie as soon as.
All right.
Mammoth as a farce.
Okay. Color me intrigued.
Yeah, you really haven't seen Jaws as a Volcano. It's one of my favorite Tom Hanks movies after Bachelor Party and
Splash.
I'm going to see it right after I watch Gremlins. I'm going to watch that.
And don't be
the first half of Joe vs. the Volcano is really, really awesome, and the second half's not quite as good, but it also has Abe Vigoda as a Polynesian in it, spoiler alert. So,
wow.
Let's start there, shall we? I love that movie, and you guys suck for not seeing it, and for mentioning Star Wars ever, and 2012. Okay.
And there is
I win the number two.
There's actual lava.
I don't want to spoil it if you haven't seen it. I'm bummed that I have to even describe Joe versus the Volcano to you without, because I've already said too much. The fact that there is a volcano in it is a huge spoiler.
It's kind of in the title, but okay.
No, but you think it might be a metaphor, or that won't actually. Do you want me to tell you the plot, or are you going to see it?
No, don't tell me the plot, but it does have me wondering, how can one guy fight a volcano, and who wins?
Ah! Oh, it ain't what you think.
All right.
It ain't who you think. It ain't the volcano you think. Ah, movie's great. I can't believe he didn't get another gig out of that. Poor John Patrick Shanley's. See Joe versus the Volcano and stop listening to this ridiculous foolishness.
Is the volcano an actual volcano, or is it another V word?
He's an actual Joe. Oh, never mind.
All right.
Man, you guys aren't real lot fans if you haven't seen Volcano.
Yeah, I know.
You guys are softcore. You sicken me.
Dingus, what is the best lava movie ever made?
Ever made.
Yeah, what's the best use of lava in a movie ever, of all time?
But this is so easy. My number one lava movie.
Did you steal?
Please don't say.
Did you steal?
Please don't say.
Are we all going to have the same number one? You know what? All at the same time. Let's count down and then all at the same time say our number one. I'm serious about this.
Okay.
I'm going to go 3, 2, 1, and right after one, everybody say the name of your movie, okay?
Mine's not Dingus's. I mean, you haven't seen mine. But you want me to say on 3, 2, 1 what I think Dingus's is?
Yes.
Okay. I'll do that.
Okay. So here we go. So I'm going to do mine. Dingus, you're going to do yours. Kelly Wand, you're going to predict Dingus's. Ready? Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Return of the King.
What? Oh, yeah. That's a good one. What did Dingus say?
Dingus stole mine. All right, Dingus, take it away. You got it first.
I didn't even think of that one.
What did you guess, Kelly Wand? I didn't even hear you.
Star Trek 3, I say.
You took that off the table last week, and I honored that.
I never listen to this crap. I don't have time. I'm here for it. Okay, what? Return of the King?
Yeah.
Not real lava, because it's fantasy lava, so it's not the same substance as magma. It's elvish lava.
That's not true. What would elvish lava be doing in Mordor? Huh?
It's enchanted lava, so it's its own category. Did we lose Dingus again to his wretched hotel Wi-Fi?
Here.
right here.
Pity.
I picked this because I wanted to hear Tom say the word Ecuador.
It's just stupid.
I will, though, tell you guys. So here's just a little bit of trivia. This is, I think, the earliest instance of my spoiler aversion. And things I might have told you this, so bear with me. When I was a kid, probably in, I guess, junior high, I'm reading these Lord of the Rings books. I'm a big fan of Dungeons and Dragons. I'm a total, like, fantasy dork. And I'm reading Lord of the Rings, and I'm kind of digging it. And someone says to me, "Oh, do you know that part at the end where Gollum bites off his finger and falls in the lava?" And I don't
remember who
did that to me, but yeah, and I stopped reading the books right there. That's why I never finished the books as a kid.
You just did that to a little kid who listens to the podcast.
We don't allow kids because there's cussing on this podcast. Children laugh.
Oh.
And so that right there is, you know, junior high. That was one of my first instances of, well, you just spoiled it. That should be like a reveal. It should be something that I discover at the end of the book. And I've kind of lost a lot of motivation to finish reading the books. So
that kid totally ruined Lord of the Rings for you till I saw
the movies.
Silly movies. Yeah.
And even then, I didn't like the movies when I saw them. It took, you know, there's a whole separate journey kind of going on there before I became the Tolkien geek that I am today. Kelly, want to ask me some Tolkien trivia?
Who made the Silmarils?
The elves.
Awesome.
Is that true?
Yeah, I guess so.
See?
What race is Sauron?
I'm going to let Dingus handle that. Is he a Numenor? Or Numenin?
This is dumb.
Numina?
He's a Na'vi.
Your sister's not going to care about this.
Dingus said he's a Na'vi. I like that. All right, so Dingus and I...
More Cameron from Dingus. Cameron apologist. Thanks, Dingus.
Oh, and thanks, Giant Eagles.
Oh, yeah. Deus Ex Machina Deluxe. So, yeah, Lord of the Rings ends with an accidental tripping, which they've kind of amplified.
I don't think it's a tripping. I think he's just so gleeful that he's it's not that he accidentally trips. He's just so completely oblivious to everything.
Probably, in the book, it seems more like he trips.
Oh, does it?
Go read the passage. To me, it does.
Well, I've never read him because I know what happens at the end. So.
Oh, remember the Scouring of the Shire? Does that happen at the end?
That's going to be a Blu-ray extended edition, I hope.
My number one was Island at the Top of the World, that 1974 Disney
that you showed us the poster for. Kelly, why don't you describe the poster for Island at the Top of the World?
It's got it's a scene. Okay, there's Vikings in it and a blimp burning, and they're at the North Pole running from Vikings while a blimp blows up over their head from lava.
See, that sounds like one of your plot descriptions. I just...
There's also a whale's graveyard. Spoiler alert.
Now tell the truth, Kelly Wand. We looked up the poster to that. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. That's why you picked this topic. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yep.
I want to praise that movie because it made a big impression on me when I was like 6.
Yeah, but you haven't gone back and seen it to realize that it's
basically... It's never on. I want to. Right. They'll remake it with crappy, I don't know. Brett Ratner will remake it next year.
I don't think they're going to remake that. That's like from a tradition of Jules Verne stuff. That's like those Disney adventures that nobody really
does. Live actions. Yeah, they don't do live action movies anymore. That's true. I agree with you. And I'm not being facetious. It's all CG, 3D. No one likes 3D, and they're just going to keep making them till one of us cracks.
Well, apparently Step Up 3D did not do that well, so maybe that'll be it's a warning shot off the
bat. Nail in the coffin, yeah. I thought you didn't understand sports. Island at the Top of the World, starring the great Donald Sinden and Mako. And Ooh. David Hartman from Good Morning America is in it.
Is he the hero?
Yeah, David Hartman's the hero of
it. That can't be right.
He plays an archaeologist, I swear to God. There's like a hot girl in it, too.
All right.
Forget her name.
Why are
Anita Ekmir? She's like a what's that Fellini girl? Anita Ekberg.
Anita Ekberg.
Jedbird.
Rainbird. Worst podcast we've ever done.
All right, what do we get? So for next week, what is our 3x3?
Wait!
Oh, they're more. Runners up. Right. That's right.
Yes.
We'll have long lists of runners up.
Because this topic demands more and more words said about it. Fantasia. With the dinosaurs.
Oh, that's good.
Star Trek III, The Core, and Journey to the Center of the Earth, the Pat Boone one, not the stupid Brendan Fraser thing.
Right, now, Kelly Wand, The Core and Journey to the Center of the Earth, that's not lava, that's magma.
No, no, look it up. Lava is... It's generated from the Earth's core, so that's lava.
Dingus's son, just through Dingus, had this was just explained to Dingus, Dingus's son. When it's in the Earth's skin, it's magma. When it's spilled, it's lava. Them's the rules. I didn't write them, Kelly Wand. I just honor them.
Wait, it says on Wikipedia, which is a geological watermark. This molten rock is formed in the interior of some planets, including Earth. There you go.
There you go. Formed the there, but it's not lava until it's been spewed forth.
No, magma. Yeah, actually, you're right. I think this is right. Forget it. I'm an idiot.
All right, so that was a great 3x3. That was awesome, Kelly Wand.
Whew. Still going, in a way. What are your runners up, smart people?
Let's see. My runners up are... Let me look here. Fish tank. And 44-inch chest.
Hmm. Interesting. No Toy Story? Toy Story had lava in it.
No, that was just molten trash.
Oh.
Mine is Manhattan Murder Mystery and Pulp Fiction.
I almost chose Brokeback Mountain, but decided not to.
Pulp Fiction, because he says, maybe if he had some lava, I could have done a better job.
Oh, wait, what is that line about?
It's about washing his hands.
There's also lava in the briefcase. You can tell
very good. Below.
Spoiler alert.
All right, so I can't wait to do a different 3x3. What do you got for us?
All right, this week's 3x3 is inspired by the film we just saw. And
I like it's already better than the lava one.
It is your top three protagonist ass kickings. But by this I mean I'm looking for beatdowns. I'm not looking for fights. I'm looking for your top three when the good guy gets beat down.
Right. The protagonist is getting the ass kicking, not administering the ass kicking.
Absolutely. He or she is getting beat down.
I like this, Dingus. I like it.
Yeah.
All right, good. I don't think you need to say any more.
Good.
Wow. Yeah, I've already got some in mind.
Dingus is the best 3x3 comer-upper.
Don't steal mine. I've got one that I really like. Don't steal it.
Since that wretched Desert Island one. It's totally improved. Kind of 180. That was just lava.
All right, good. So we had a little bit of a... there was a lot of behind-the-scenes strife that you listeners aren't privy to about what we're seeing next week. There was much.
It was as boring as this
kicking.
Was.
There was a protagonist ass kicking. I won't say who administered and who received it, but what we eventually decided to see next week is not the Expendables, but Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So there was an ass.
That was not an ass kicking. That was me changing my vote three times to accommodate you.
I was being facetious. I was just trying to do a callback, you know.
But then they're going to think I'm... Or never mind.
Why did you just out yourself as him wanting to see the Expendables?
Because the slander was outrageous.
But I didn't name any names. How can you slander if you don't...
Well, I thought you actually believed that I was beat down, or anyone was beat down.
We discussed it. I think different people were swayed different ways, and we all decided that instead of seeing another A-Team / The Losers type action thing, we're going to see whatever in the world Scott Pilgrim versus the World is.
It's about him getting beat down. Spoiler alert!
I've got to get together with you two and play poker against you.
Tom would suck at poker. He's always giggling.
Okay, so I just want to... This is a very minor tie-in to the movie that we just saw this week. I have played poker with John Hawkes.
What? Yep. No way.
I actually knew a friend of John Hawkes that I did theater with when I first moved to Los Angeles. And I was at a couple of poker games where... And he's just such a nice, personable fellow. I mean, just like you would imagine. So there you go. And it's before poker was like something really hip that people would do and would be good.
Was he good? Did he clean your clock?
I don't really... You know, it was just like nickel poker. We were just a bunch of like out-of-work actor types. And I just... you know, it was before.
And he went on to great success, and you went on to the podcasting.
That's right. Yep.
Interesting.
Did you get naked?
With them?
Who told you about
it? Was it strip poker?
It was not.
Or lava poker.
But yeah, Dingus, if you want to play poker sometime, I've been told that I'm very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. These micropones is.
So those of you listening, I apologize for some of this podcast. You know what, Kelly Wan? I don't mind a bad 3x3. That was like a palate cleanser, by the way.
Yeah. And it'll make the other ones look good.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing to throw out there. I'm curious to see what people will do with it in the thread. You know, what makes a good lava scene? Tell us that.
Winter's Bone was about enduring bad times, and this podcast was about enduring my topic.
But I'm sure there's some important things to be said about, like, the dramatic role of lava in adventure movies. And you know what? It can kick off a whole discussion about that Star Wars prequel. People like talking about that. They like talking about Star Wars movies. You brought that up. You know, they like talking about those Hobbit movies. I like that. So, Kelly Wan, you've tapped into a rich vein of material here.
Get it?
So join us next week for a different 3x3, top three protagonist ass kickings. I'm looking forward to that, and we will be seeing Scott Pilgrim versus the world. And join.
Who's going to win?
Yeah, exactly. Who's going to win? Who knows? We'll find out. I am Tom Chick. I have been joined by Christian McCracken. I can't read my writing. It's like Christian McCracken.
You're getting closer all the time. It's Christian Morosky.
Okay, I wasn't. Yeah. And also Kelly Wand.
If you enjoyed this audio program, be sure to visit our sponsor.
Who never talked about the things we would miss. What's said must be a conversation.
Put that sky up there and this old mud down here. Made it so pretty if you didn't want us to work it and to love it.